Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the growing use of robots, essentially robotic technologies, in military applications and on the battlefield. And for example, right now, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, there are over 1,200 unmanned systems on the ground operating, and that's really another way of saying robots. They're involved in the war effort in both of these places. 5 years ago, there were none. This morning, we'll talk about some of the ways that technology is changing the experience of war and the profile of the warrior. And our guest for the program is P.W. Singer. He is considered one of the world's leading experts on changes in 21st century warfare. He's a senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He has written widely on this subject. He's been quoted in a lot of places, Boston Globe, L.A. Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Foreign Affairs. He's also provided commentary on military affairs for major TV and radio outlets and is the author of a recently published book that deals with this subject. The title of his book is Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. It's published by the Penguin Press and is out now if you're interested in reading on that subject. And, of course, questions here this morning are welcome as well. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so that one is free. If it would be long-distance call for you, you can use that number. And that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask is that people keep their questions brief so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guest, P.W. Singer, is speaking with us from Brookings. So we have the opportunity to have this high-level, high-quality connection. Almost sounds like he's here, but he is in Washington today. And Mr. Singer, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Just to give an example here of what we're talking about right at the beginning, I'm sure people, when you say something like, when you use a word like robot, people will have certain associations. So give us some examples here about some of these robotic devices that are now being used on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan.
There is an incredible array of these unmanned systems out there. It's in many ways feels like science fiction is becoming battlefield reality. On the ground, there's 22 different types of ground robotics. And just to give you, again, a sense of these numbers, just a few years ago, there were zero. When we went into Iraq during the invasion in 2003, we had zero of them. We now have 12,000. A typical example on the ground is the PACBOT. The PACBOT is about the size of a lawnmower. It's a robot that is used, at first was for reconnaissance. Think about it like a mobile pair of binoculars. But soon they figured out, you know what, if you can see it, we want to do something with it. And, for example, they've attached an arm and series of cameras to it that allow them to defuse these IEDs, these roadside bombs, without the soldier having to get near that bomb. The same kind of transformation has happened in the air. We went into Iraq with just a handful of drones, of unmanned air systems, pilotless planes. We now have 7,000. And they, again, cover the gamut from large ones like a lot of people have heard of the Predator drone or the Global Hawk. To give you a sense of the Global Hawk's capabilities, it's a large plane, a little bit bigger than a small Cessna plane. It could take off from San Francisco on its own, fly 3,000 miles to the state of Maine, stay in the air for 24 hours hunting for terrorists in the state of Maine using high-powered cameras, radar, infrared, etc. And then after that 24 hours, still in the air, fly all the way back to San Francisco and land by itself. And again, this is just one type. You have very tiny robots the size of bugs. You almost could think of them as bugs with bugs because they're used for spying and the like. It's an amazing array that's going on there.
Yeah. The obvious appeal of things like the PACBOT, for example, are that you can send them into situations where a person's would be in jeopardy where here in this particular case, maybe you wouldn't want to lose this thing because they are expensive. But there's one of the quotes that you dropped is that there was one soldier said, you know, you don't have to write a letter home to a robot's mother. That's the obvious appeal, is that it's possible to save lives or reduce the risk to soldiers who were serving in these places, doing things that are both dirty, dull, and dangerous. That's the, you say they're good for the 3 Ds, all those kinds of jobs.
Yeah, the 3 Ds, dirty, dull, and dangerous, sort of captures a lot of the push behind using these robots more and more. And the way to think about it is you are the weakest link when it comes to war. The human has certain costs to it. One, dull. Can you keep your eyes open for 30 hours? Can you keep your eyes open for 30 hours watching empty desert sand? A robot can. Dirty. Can you operate in a chemical or biological environment? Or more importantly, can you see in the dark? Can you see in a dust storm? A robotic system can. And then most important, the real driver here is dangerous. As you put it, these systems, you're able to send them out to roles that it would be tough to send a soldier out to. And they can there's hundreds of soldiers that are alive today because of these systems carrying out roles, be it defusing a bomb, be it going into a house where you don't know who's on the other side of that door. Now, there's a ripple effect, though, of this. We need to remember that while these technologies are incredible and they're maybe even revolutionary, they're having ripple effects onto our politics, onto our law, onto our ethics. And that's really what the book is about is, first part, let's capture the stories, the cool stories out there of people who are working with robots, everything from the 19-year-old drone pilot to the 4-star general who commands him. What does the Iraqi insurgent think about these systems? What is it like to be a scientist inventing them? What do the science fiction authors who are influencing this, what do they think of all of this stuff? Let's take a visit to the Red Cross. What do they think about what's going on here, Human Rights Watch? But these things also are having ripple effects. And so, for example, if you're drawing down the human costs of war, does it make you more cavalier about the use of force? Does it make you more likely to go to war? And that's an example of something we need to wrestle with.
Mm. And also the obvious question that if you're, to put it bluntly, if you're killing by remote control, if you are the person who is pulling the trigger, but you are removed from that experience, does that somehow make it for you less real? And does that somehow make it easier for you to pull the trigger?
Yeah, it's a great issue. And there were two people I met with that I think captured this well at the high and low level of war. At the high level, was meeting with a fellow who was a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Ronald Reagan. And he said, I'm a big fan of these systems because they save lives. But I also am becoming worried about us having more marketization of war, more shock and awe talk, to defray discussion of the costs of war. And he concluded by saying, people are more likely to go to war if they think it's costless. At the next level, at the warriors level, one of the people that I met with was a pilot of Predator drones. And his experience of going to war was never leaving Nevada. He was taking out insurgents via remote in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, but he was never leaving Nevada. And he said, the experience of fighting is, and this is his words, a lot like playing a video game. Mm-hmm. And that's an incredible challenge when you think about the ripple effects on the soldier themselves. But also, for example, what about the commander of those units? And one of the fascinating interviews was with a Predator Squadron commander who said, look, my job is actually a lot harder commanding this unit fighting by remote than it was when I commanded a unit out in Iraq. All the complications of doing it by remote are just way more difficult on leadership.
Mm. Our guest, just quickly to introduce again, P.W. Singer, is one of the world's leading experts on changes in 21st century warfare, something that he writes about in his book Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. Penguin Press is the publisher. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and speaking with us from there. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly you can understand that there would be civilian applications for some of the things that we're talking about here. The law enforcement, you can imagine them using them, and there are probably other certs, other jobs that are, that qualify as dirty, dull, and dangerous where you could use things like this. Are these devices that we're talking about, some of them we're talking about, did they already exist? Were they in use and someone said that there were military applications? Or was it the case that they were really primarily developed right from the get-go as things that would appeal to the Department of Defense?
It's actually often going in the opposite direction, where it's something originally worked on for the military that then is starting to have commercial applications. And that's nothing new. You know, that's what happened with airplanes. That's what happened with radar. That's what happened with, you know, GPS. GPS was originally designed to help our missiles get on the right targets, our tanks navigate desert sands. Well, now you and I use it to, you know, find the nearest gas station when we're in a rental car. And so with these robotics, it's a real fascinating connection. The book opens with a visit to iRobot. iRobot is it's a real-world company based out of Boston, Massachusetts, that's named after the fictional Isaac Asimov novel and the not-so-great Will Smith movie. And iRobot is known not only for making the PackBot, which is one of the most used robots in Iraq, but it also makes the Roomba, the little robot vacuum cleaner that they've sold a good 4 million of these. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can get them at the mall and the like. And the Roomba, this little robot vacuum cleaner, actually first came out of a design for a military robot that was designed to clean up cluster bomblets from airfields. So, you know, first it was supposed to suck up bombs, and then they figured out, you know what, it might be equally good at sucking up dust or pet dander or something like that. And it's this fascinating example of the cross between commercial and military. And, you know, as I joke, the company iRobot, it may be the only company in the world that sells both to the Pentagon but also to Lenin's and things.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone here where we are in Champaign County to start off. Line one. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that the corporate involvement in this, I don't know how much detail you go into, but as well as articles about the impact on the people that are controlling these things, and it isn't a robot until there's some kind of artificial intelligence involved. I think that's important to stress, too. And that's even more scary in some ways to have the decision out of an individual's hands. But San Diego seems to be one of the sites where this is done, and I think it ties in. My suspicion is that scientific applications in international computing, SAIC, is fundamentally involved in working on this. And they've just the larger thing is this battlefield control mechanisms, and there's been a huge contract for something called Project Deep Green, I guess, that SAIC is working on with some other corporations that would supposedly be some kind of integrated battleship management system that I don't know whether you've looked at that or whether you have any comments on it, but it seems to me that this is, as you say, extremely insidious. And I really have to run, so I'm going to listen to you the rest of the show on the air. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
It's an interesting issue because one of the things we have going on with technology that people are probably familiar with is Moore's Law, the idea that every 2 years roughly we're able to pack more and more computing power into our systems so that they double their power. Moore's Law is the reason why, for example, if you buy a Hallmark card that plays a little song when you open it up, you know, a lot of people are probably going to do that for Valentine's Day. Well, that card, that greeting card, has the same amount of computing power that the entire Pentagon did back in 1964. And take Moore's Law and push it forward. And it means within 25 years, if Moore's Law holds true, that our systems will be a billion times more powerful than today, literally a billion. And so it opens up a lot of what seem like totally science fiction possibilities and that play out in, within our lifetimes or even today. And the caller mentioned, for example, battle management systems. And these are the idea of using artificial intelligence to provide advice for generals. And there's already these systems right now. They help sift through information, help develop mission orders and the like. Now, what interests me is, you know, is not so much the technology, but the implications of that technology. So a battle management system, what parts should the system be able to decide when it comes to missions and war, and what parts do you leave just to the human commander? Or one of the people I met with was a general in the U.S. Air Force, and he said, what about the legal side of this? What if I don't take the advice of my battle management system? If it works out better, people will go, aha, human instinct is better. Well done, General. But what if it works out worse, that I don't take the advice of the system and it works out worse? And for example, there's a friendly fire incident or more civilians are killed. Am I legally responsible? Is that something that you can say, you know, General, you didn't listen to your AI, you should have taken the advice, you're now legally culpable for not following it? That's an example of the sort of ripple effects that we have to start wrestling with.
Yeah. Well, there's also another kind of example, is that it, and that is what happens when you take the advice of the system and it turns out to be a bad choice.
And who do you hold accountable?
And I think that there are certainly examples where you have systems. It makes me think of your earlier comment about the human being the weak link. You know, there are systems that are designed to assess the situation, gather information, process that all, and then make a decision about what should happen. And then there's a human who is going to either say, well, yes, I think that's a good thing, that's what we will do, or it has the opportunity, the person has the opportunity to override the artificial intelligence, the part of the system that's making that decision. And I think one of the things that you've written about is the fact that often in these sorts of situations that the human beings tend to defer to the machine, that perhaps they don't as often as they should question whether, in fact, that's the thing to do. And that can also create problems.
Yeah, two great points that come out of that. One is, even though you have Moore's Law, you have this incredible doubling effect of technology and the systems are getting smarter and smarter and more autonomous, it doesn't mean you don't still have Murphy's Law. You know, it's the parallel to, I have a really great laptop computer and it can do incredible things, but you know what? It often crashes. This is the same thing with robotics. It's just you're talking about your computer is armed with an M16 rifle. And so you have all of these questions that come out of that where, you know, what happens when the system crashes and what happens if it goes wrong? Who do you hold accountable? The soldier, the software engineer, you know, who knows? The other part of this is that while we don't like to talk about it, we are getting more and more of these autonomous systems that are making more and more of their own decisions. And the role of the man in the loop, so to speak, is getting smaller and smaller because it's not just that the systems are getting smarter, but that the time that we have to react in war is shrinking down. A good example of this that's highlighted in the book is a system called the CRAM, the Counter Rocket Artillery Mortar System. And the soldiers call it R2-D2 because it looks a little bit like R2-D2, except if you gave him a six-barrel machine gun. And they use it in Iraq and now Afghanistan, where it shoots down incoming artillery and rockets and mortar rounds. And these things are coming in so quick, the human on the ground doesn't have any time to react. You know, they can basically get to mid-curse word. That's about it. Well, this system shoots down the rocket in midair, and so it's an incredible capability, but the human role in it is basically turning it on and off. That's it. After that, it just goes. And, of course, it's also had a couple mistakes. You know, one time, little R2-D2 mistook a U.S. Army helicopter for the Death Star and actually targeted one of our own helicopters as was coming in. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is the kind of weird science fiction things you get into when you turn things over to real-world robotics.
Yeah. Well, I think the caller's right to make a distinction between something that is a remote-controlled device and something that is truly autonomous, that's designed to operate completely on its own. There are some things like that. Is the idea that that it might be more common that we would have more devices that completely, basically, what you the only thing that a human being does is turn it on, and from then on, it runs itself.
Yeah, the two things out of that. The first is you don't even need to have fully autonomous systems to get all of these kind of ripple effects on our politics, on our society. You know, the experience of going to war is fundamentally changed even for someone fighting from remote. You have someone in the loop, but they are no longer going to war in the way we used to think about it. You know, my grandfather went to war in World War II in the Pacific Fleet. That meant he went to a place where there was great danger such that our family might never see him again. That's a very different experience than, for example, a Predator drone pilot who is in control of the system, but he's flying it. The system may be over Iraq or Pakistan, but he's not leaving Nevada. And his experience of going to war is basically getting up in the morning, getting in his Toyota Corolla, commuting into work, spending 12 hours putting missiles on targets, and then getting back in the Toyota Corolla and driving home. And as one guy put it, you know, 20 minutes after you're shooting at people, you're sitting at the dinner table talking to your kids about their homework. So even without autonomy, we get a lot of weird, crazy stories, interesting dilemmas that come out of it. But then the other part is we are definitely getting more and more systems that do have autonomy. In the research for the book, I came across four different Pentagon projects on armed autonomous systems. And one of them had a great name. It was called Taking Humans Out of the Loop. That was the name of the very project itself.
Our guest is Peter Singer, B.W. Singer. He's a senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He is speaking with us from there. He's considered to be one of the world's leading experts on changes in 21st century warfare, and this is something that he writes about in his book, Wired for War. It's published by Penguin Press. It's out recently. If you'd like to read it, you can seek the book out. Questions are welcome to 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. How much money so far has been spent on developing and deploying devices like these that we've been talking about?
Oh, it's a huge growth industry. On the commercial side, Bill Gates describes robotics as being where he saw computers at roughly in 1980, that they were there. They were being used for a limited set of roles, but they were poised for a breakout, not only in the world of defense, but also beyond. In the world of defense, this has been one of the biggest growth areas that's there. And in fact, a lot of people looking at the future of Pentagon budgeting say, you know what, the overall budget is going to shrink slightly, but the unmanned systems area is going to continue to grow. Just to give you a sense of the amount of use of drones has gone up by 14,000% over the last 5 years. That's a huge growth vector.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Something that I don't think has been discussed yet is the influence on leadership. If they don't have to worry about bodies coming back, there's much less deterrent to going to war when there are other alternatives, and there almost always are. There's a real temptation for a leader, not necessarily our own, but anywhere, to use force as a first choice.
Well, Mr. Singer?
It's a great issue, and it's something I very much was fascinated in the book, and so I went around interviewing various American politicians and a couple foreign politicians about the impact of this. And the first issue that came out of that, very much as the caller noted, there's a concern that it may make us more cavalier about the use of force, more ready to use force. And we're already seeing this in certain parts of our body politic. There was an op-ed in the Washington Post just a couple of weeks ago that said, you know, look, we may not be willing to send troops into harm's way and to stop the genocide in Darfur. Well, why don't we use drones instead? Now, set aside the whole issue of doing a humanitarian intervention with inhuman machines. I mean, that's a weird irony to begin with. But it also points to how this sort of seen as this cheap and easy way. Oh, we'll just send drones instead, and we won't have to worry about body bags coming home. It forgets, though, that any military operation, be it manned or unmanned, is complicated. It involves you in very difficult political, social, cultural issues on the ground. You can't just fight from afar. The other part is that, of course, it doesn't work out the way that you plan all the time. And then finally, you have this messaging effect. You may be doing it to show that you care, but you're also going to show that you don't care enough. And the impact of this that I see on our politics here in the U.S. is that we already have certain trends in play, and robotics may help take them to their final logical ending point. You know, we don't have a draft anymore. We don't have formal declarations of war anymore by Congress. We don't buy war bonds anymore. And now we have this systems that are taking more and more of those who would go into harm's way and replacing them with machines. And so the political effect of this may be taking the already lowering bars to war and dropping them to the ground.
It seems to me there's really an acute danger of this. I had the privilege of spending 2 years in the Army when I was a draftee many years ago. And it has the advantage of depriving you of any romantic notions of the military. And I fear that's something fewer and fewer Americans have the advantage of. I've spoken to and discussed matters with members of the military of various ranks over the last few years, and they seem to have almost a contempt for what civilian political leaders and diplomats can do. In the end, they're the ones that do the job. And I think this is a hubris that is extraordinarily dangerous and would be only magnified if they could do it by remote control. And it seems to me to increase the danger of terrorist tactics being used by less powerful groups and states. You can't fight the major powers, so you hurt them the way you can.
Well, again, I think that this this we talked a little bit about this earlier, and I think that the caller obviously makes an excellent point that you can look at this on several levels, on the level of the military and military planners, on the level of the political leadership, on the level of the general public, whether in all of those cases, if you have these devices that allow you to make war without putting humans at risk, it may well make it more likely that you make the decision to go to war. Here, obviously, now this is something that you're thinking about, people like you who are in the think tank world think about. Is this something that, say, within the Pentagon or elsewhere within the political sphere, that there are people who are seriously thinking about these very implications, these questions that are that grow out of these weapon systems that we are already using?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, and that's the fun thing of writing a book that's one of the first to look at the topic, is that hopefully you're taking something that is, as one Pentagon analyst put it to me, you know, this is all just, quote, mere science fiction. Well, it may sound like science fiction, but as the numbers we talked about show, it's battlefield reality. It's not a fiction that we have 12,000 unmanned ground systems. It's not a fiction that we have 7,000 more in the air. It's not a fiction that that Predator drone pilot's experience I talked about of, you know, fighting in wars. It's not a fiction, the impression that the Iraqi insurgent is getting of those systems. You know, one of the people I interviewed there. And what I fear is that because these things seem like science fiction and often look like science fiction, because in many ways they're actually inspired by science fiction. That's one of the crazy things too, is that I've interviewed a member, a Marine colonel, talking about a certain system they built, and they got the idea exactly from – he was watching Star Wars with his kid and said, oh, we could do something like that. The point is that just because something seems like science fiction – it may be keeping us in denial about the reality of it right now. And we could be well making the very same mistake that a previous generation did about another technology that sounded like science fiction, atomic bombs. You know, the very word atomic weapon, atomic bomb, comes from an H.G. Wells short story in 1911. And the whole idea of nuclear chain reactions, also originally science fiction. And so people didn't talk about those issues until after Pandora's box was opened up. And I'm hoping that the book, you know, not only does it gather a lot of cool, funny stories, interesting things from all the people playing in this field, but also gives us a framework for how we might seriously talk about these issues in a way that's not just for jokes, but says, you know, okay, let's look at the impact on war. Let's look at the impact on politics. Let's look at the impact on our ethics, on our law. Because if we don't have those conversations, we're going to regret not having them a couple years from now.
Yeah. We talked earlier about the rapid growth in the use of these things, that, and one of the numbers that you gave talking about these kind of unmanned ground systems, things like the PAC-BOT, that in 2003 in Iraq there weren't any of them, and that by the end of last year there were something like 12,000, and that people are expecting the use of these things are going to grow. Initially, when they were introduced for field testing and they were put out there on the ground in this conflict situation, did the military people, were they skeptical at first? Did they need to be convinced? Or were they fairly quickly, did they say, hey, this is a good thing. I like this. Give me some more of this.
It was originally skepticism. These systems, I don't like them. I don't need them. They're not as good as me. They're not as good as my soldiers. And I don't like where this is all headed. But then they started to save lives. And that's the difference maker. And there's a great scene in the book where a unit is testing out a prototype of it, of a certain system, and the commander who's just back from Iraq tells the general in charge, if I had had this system in Iraq with me, my unit leader would be alive today and my sergeant would have his leg back. And he actually tried to keep the prototype. They were supposed to take the prototype back at the end of the testing. And he said, we want to keep it. And it points to, you know, the value that people are seeing in these systems. And the parallel way to think about this is sort of like the plane or the tank in World War I. They were very early models. They were rickety. They weren't all that great. But by the end of World War I, you knew they weren't going away, that they were going to become a part of war. And that's the same experience with robotics. These systems that we're using right now may be amazing in a certain way, but they're also the Model T Fords. They're the Wright Flyers. They're the very first generation of these systems. And so what's coming is far more amazing. But it also is raising a lot of questions within the military about things like professional identity. You know, what does it do to your identity as a soldier to be fighting from afar? Or there's a huge amount of tension that's building between, for example, the special operations troops who are on the ground and the air support that they're getting that's actually not just some guy flying above you, but some guy who's living at home and commutes into work. And one of the guys I interviewed talked about how he was a special operations captain, and he talked about how he had more respect for the terrorists that he was fighting than for the fellow soldiers who were flying these machines. And that's a really interesting divide to see within the military.
Yeah. Well, certainly you pointed to the fact that over time, new technologies are introduced. And just a couple of examples of the things that you mentioned, tanks and planes. And the time that they were first introduced, people really weren't sure about them, weren't sure whether they would work, how they would work, how they would be used. And now, of course, that's an accepted part of war fighting. Is this really, and maybe you've already given examples that answer the question, but is this really so different from times before when some kind of new technology has been introduced on the battlefield?
It's both the same and different. That's an awful way of answering it, but it's the sort of the truth of how history happens in cycles but doesn't always exactly repeat itself. That is, every so often you get a technology that comes along that rewrites the rules of the game, forces us to ask new questions about not only what's possible, but also things like what's proper, what's right or wrong. And examples of that in war are things like the gunpowder revolution or the machine gun or the atomic bomb. And robotics is a little bit like that. And there's a difference, though, here in that every previous revolution in war was about changing the how of war. That is, it was a system that either had a bigger boom, shot faster, or went further. Now, that's certainly happening with robotics, but they also are different in that they are affecting the who of war, not just the how of war. That is, they're affecting warriors' very experience of going to war, even the identity of warriors themselves. And so, you know, we are living through the breakdown of humankind's 5,000-year-old monopoly on war, and that's a rather big deal. And the thing to remember here is that these revolutions are not just about what changes the fighting. It's about the ripple effects, the second and third order effects that come out of it. So, you know, you mentioned the changes that happened in World War I. That's all centers around the introduction of the internal combustion engine to war, you know, in the tank and the airplane and the like. Well, before World War I, Ford Motor Company was selling just a couple hundred Model T Fords every year. By the last year of World War I, mainly driven by military, it's selling 1 million Model T Fords every year. And then, of course, we see the ripple effects outwards onto that, where you get things like the creation of suburbia. You know, the American city changes because of the automobile. You get social impacts that come out of that. You didn't have the concept of dating before this. You know, people courted each other on their front porch. Well, now you've got this new thing called teenagers who are able to go out on dates because of the independence that these automobiles give them. And it's the same sort of thing with robotics. We're just starting to see the ripple effects outwards onto our society, onto our laws, onto our, you know, politics, et cetera. And that's what makes them really revolutionary. The robot's revolution is not that you're going to be attacked by your Roomba vacuum cleaner. It's the revolution that's happening in history.
We have another caller here. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Peter Singer. He's a senior fellow, director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to read more on this subject, you can look for his new book. It's titled Wired for War, published by Penguin Press. Next, we'll talk with a caller, someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, Urbana, actually.
Oh, pardon me. Well, go ahead.
Every weapon system that has been developed in the history of man there have been countermeasures that have been brought against them. And my question is, what sort of countermeasures might there be, and what sort of countries might be poised in the best position to develop countermeasures? I'm thinking of, India with its fantastic software development and that sort of thing, and also China, of course, with a tremendous economic power that it's been developing. It seems to me that, of course, whatever we develop, somebody else is going to develop something to counter them.
Well, good question.
Yeah, it's a fantastic issue to explore, and again, these technologies may offer you incredible capabilities, but they're just the start of the story. They're not the end of the story. And there's always a back and forth in war. And we're seeing this even with robotics right now. And the countermeasures can be both low-tech or high-tech. Low-tech, the Iraqi insurgents are already have developed all sorts of responses to our robotics, and it's everything from developing ambushes that are as low-tech as a tiger trap. It's basically a large ditch that's covered over that the robot drives, and then guess what? It falls in the ditch and can't get out, to more sophisticated, like jamming the communications between the person controlling the robot and the robot itself. you get into a bigger array when you move into things like computer hacking. And, you know, look, there's no system that isn't hackable. And that's a definite vulnerability for these systems, is the linkages and communications. Now, what's interesting about that is that's another reason that pushes you down the pathway of having more armed autonomous systems, because the military is saying, well, if they're going to be jammed, if they're going to be hacked, we don't want them to just stop in the middle of the battlefield and just sit there. It has to still be able to carry out its mission on its own. And so that drives you towards giving them this AI to be more autonomy. One other lesson of history is not just that people develop countermeasures, but also it's a scary fact that there's no such thing as a permanent first mover advantage. That's true in technology. You know, none of us still use Wang computers. And it's the same thing in war. You know, the tank. The British and the French were the first ones to use it. It's the Germans who figured out how to use it better. And with robotics right now, the U.S. is certainly ahead of the game in military robotics, but that doesn't always have to be the case. And there's 43 other countries that are working on military robotics that I came across in the book research. And they include both allies, but also potential adversaries like China, like Russia, like Pakistan, like Iran. And the thing we have to ask ourselves is, what is it? Where are we going to be in this revolution, given the state of our manufacturing and the state of the science and mathematics training in our schools? And sort of an endpoint question is this: what does it mean to be going to war with more and more soldiers whose hardware is made in China and whose software is written in India?
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks very much. We have maybe about, again, 5-6 minutes left. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. When we have on and off used the word robot, and when you say that, people are going to get a particular image in their heads, the idea of the humanoid robot maybe more like C-3PO than R2-D2, something that sort of looks and moves like a person. Now, we may be a very, very long way away from something like that, but apparently within the defense community, there are people who are actually thinking about, maybe even have the expectation that, and it won't be all that long, I mean, we're talking in terms of decades, that there could be humanoid robots fighting on the battlefield next to human soldiers.
Yeah, it's robots come in all shapes and sizes right now. And actually, one of the scientists I met with said, you know, it's a little bit of human arrogance to think that we're the ideal form. There's actually, you know, other forms that might be more efficient. You know, for example, we don't have eyes in the back of our head. Well, that'd be kind of useful in war, so why don't we design them that way? Or, you know what, four legs might be better than two legs. And so you see these robots that just anything that's possible, any kind of animal they mimic, lots of different forms. But one thing that's driving the military towards humanoid robotics is the fact that these systems have to operate in the world that we've built to suit our needs. You know, they have to be able to go up and down the stairs and buildings we've built. There was a test program out in Singapore where the robot actually had to be able to figure out how to ride an elevator, which buttons to press and the like. This question of where it's headed is pretty fascinating, because we did a survey. The survey was taken of Pentagon scientists and military soldiers who'd worked with robotics, and they asked them, when do you think we'll have a humanoid equivalent infantryman? And the scientists, the average year they said was 2020. The average year that the soldiers said was 2025. Now, that's not that far off. Mm. I mean, that's well before I think most of us are going to pay off our mortgages. This is a survey. It doesn't mean that the scientists were right and the soldiers were right or wrong. It's just what they predict will happen. It could come earlier. It can come later. I actually think that you're not going to have this full-scale replacement of human soldiers, but rather it'll be mixed human and robotic teams. That seems to be the pathway that the Army's going down right now, where the humans do what they do best, the robots do what they do best, and they work together as a team. You could almost they've got a research project right now where the human soldier is equivalent to the quarterback on a football team, where they'll set the plays, give directions. Robots will be like the wide receivers that go out and carry out the plays, but also, just like in a football game, they've got enough autonomy that they can stop in mid-play and say, you know what, something else is happening differently than we planned for. I'm going to do this instead. That's what a lot of the work in the Pentagon is on right now.
Yeah. And this truly does take us into the realm of science fiction. Even going beyond that point, there are people who do entertain the notion of, at some point, having robot armies where there aren't any humans at all.
Yeah. One of the people I interviewed was an Air Force three-star general who said, we will soon be talking about wars involving tens of thousands of robots. And that's a pretty crazy future to think about. But he's serious. And this is a serious guy, three-star general serving in the Air Force right now.
A couple of minutes left here. A caller in Bloomington, Illinois. We'll talk with them on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
excuse me. You're mentioning the loss of identity of the warrior makes me question the motive for war, if that's so important. And the second thing you kind of covered was, you know, going from that, I mean, we would get to a point where we're not killing each other, but either doing it on computers or with robots, which would be wonderful, I would think. Thank you.
All right. Well, if it was only robots killing other robots, maybe. But I suppose that the danger is we're talking about a situation where we're using robots and we're using them to kill real people. And the issue is, well, as long as our people aren't getting killed, does that make us more willing to go out and do it?
Yeah, it's a great question, really to end our discussion on, and that it's actually how the last part of the book looks at is this issue of our technology is what's distinguished us. It's our technology is what's distinguished us from other species. Our creativity, you know, our creativity took us to the stars. Our creativity has built works of architecture, literature, arts to express our love for each other, and now we're using our creativity to build something that is just fantastic. These systems do incredible things. You know, some people even think one day there'll be a new species unto themselves. But the reason that we're doing it is not just because of creativity. It's because we can't get past that human bent on destroying each other. We can't get past fighting each other. And so it really begs the question, you know, is it our machines that are wired for war, or is it us?
We're talking about something that is very high tech, and some of the forces that we're fighting now, they're generally using the kind of weapons and techniques they're using are actually pretty low tech. They're on the other end of the scale. But having said all that, I suppose there is this concern that these kinds of technologies that we're talking about would fall into the hands of the people that we're fighting. Is that something that people worry about, and that these systems could then be turned against us?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book called Osama Bot Laden, and it basically looks at this cross between terrorism and robotics. And the thing is these systems aren't something that you need a huge industrial structure to build, like an aircraft carrier, an atomic bomb. A lot of them use commercial off-the-shelf technology. For about $1,000, you can build the equivalent of a Raven drone, which is one of the most popular drones that soldiers use in Iraq. Now, that means that while some people may do it just for hobbies, other people may build these systems for bad intents. And we've already seen wars that feature terrorist-like groups using unmanned systems. The war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon a couple years ago was a war between a state government and a non-state actor. Both sides flew drones against each other. Hezbollah flew 4 drones in that war. There are already the ability to go online and remotely detonate an IED in Iraq while sitting at your home computer. And this, I think, takes two trends in the realm of terrorism. One is it reinforces the power of individuals against states. It makes them more lethal. The second is that it widens the scope of people who can play in the game of terrorism. That is, you don't have to be suicidal to still have the impact of a suicide bomber. And one of the people that I interviewed for the book was Richard Clark, the U.S. government official who famously warned about 9/11 and wasn't heeded. And he said that he sees the future of terrorism being a cross between Al-Qaeda 2.0 and the next generation version of the Unabomber, that it makes organizations more lethal, but also that you're going to see individual players even more scary. And then as a further wrinkle effect, that you may see even people motivated into the game of terrorism because they can't digest all the change that's going on around them. The idea of neo-Ludditism, the idea that a very small minority was upset about the ethical issues that surround abortion, that they started blowing up abortion clinics and shooting abortion doctors. Well, is it that strange to think that there might be a violent fringe that's going to be upset about the identity issues and ethical issues that surround robotics, that they might also turn to violence? And he was very concerned about this and worrying about it.
Hmm. And just finally, are in other countries, particularly other countries that have an industrial high-tech base, are they getting into this as much as we are here in the United States?
43 other countries are working on military robotics, and they include both countries like China, Japan, massive use of robotics there, Korea, et cetera, but also countries that we wouldn't describe as having a huge technologic base. Pakistan just recently developed its own drone system. Iran recently developed a machine gun armed land robot. This is not something that's just an American space.
All right. Well, there, I think that we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Peter Singer, P.W. Singer, that's the way you'll find it if you look for the book, is a senior fellow and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C. And if you would like to read about the subject that we've been talking about, you can look for his book. The title is Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, published by the Penguin Press. And Mr. Singer, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And also we want to say thanks to Trevor Bryan. He's the tech guy at the other end of our conversation at Brookings in Washington, D.C.